In Camerosity, episode 64, the gang discussed Vivian Meyer about 15 minutes from the end.
Oh, boy. And guys, I'm sure they mentioned us as usual.
No! No. You know what? I keep up with Camerosity, and they never mention us.
They don't like
and
us.
And I know Theo, Anthony, I know these guys are fans. So it's Ekman. Ekman!
That's
Ekman!
It. That's it.
It must be that. He must have a vendetta. Should we go to war with Mike Ekman? What do you think? Is it wrong to go to war with someone?
Oh, we can do it. What the heck?
Oh, all right. All right, this means war, Ekman! Ekman!
Welcome to episode 67 of the Camerosity Podcast, the world's only smash hit podcast about cameras and camera collecting. My name is Mike Ekman, and we are back with another smash hit episode. Episode 67, big number. I keep thinking that we're so close to 70, and then when you get to 70, all you're thinking about is 100. I don't know what it is. Something, it's sort of leaning over to the side. And getting close to the big 100, so this is very, very exciting. From Central Perk in downtown New York City, the guy with lots of friends is Mr. Paul Reibel. Hey, Paul, what is your favorite smash hit television show?
Well, Mike, actually, my favorite television show was Animal Kingdom, because I really liked it when they took the babies away from their mothers and the little buggers were crying and carrying on. And then later on in the same program, you'd see Jim staked out on an anthill while Marlon was in Nairobi drinking beer and ogling the native women.
Next, from Sydney, Australia, where it is always the night shift, is Mr. Theo Panagopoulos. Hey, Theo, have you ever considered a job in the medical profession?
Yes, I had considered the medical profession, right? But I find the thrill of and challenge of producing a smash hit podcast a lot more rewarding and challenging. And you get to actually interact with nerds and psychopaths on each episode.
And finally, a guy who is neither named Will or Grace, and is certainly not a wimpy kid, is Mr. Anthony Rue. Hey Anthony, did you ever keep a diary as a kid?
No, never really kept a diary. I was neither freak nor geek, but I was sort of like the crazy art-damaged punk rock kid with a camera. So I guess the camera was the closest thing I ever came to a diary.
Before we get started, we should address this unprovoked declaration from some rival podcast. Apparently, these two new podcasters have some kind of vendetta against us, possibly because we don't know who they are. Have you guys heard of this?
I did hear about this podcast. It's something to do with a war they've actually initiated with us. I'm not quite sure what that's about, but they're a pretty good podcast. They occasionally talk about photography. It's a couple of guys. I think it's Johan and Gruber who really sort of get interacting with the photography community, talk about the important issues, and they do produce something quite mildly entertaining. I'd like to encourage people to listen to them. They are a really good podcast. I think they're called I Dream of Photography. Give it a bit of a listen and put them into your feed.
Well, I just want to say that, you know, personally, I enjoy I Dream of Cameras, although, you know, I also think that, like the Dick Van Dyke Show, which was really about the Alan Brady Show, that this is actually the Alan Perez podcast. It's not actually I Dream of Cameras. It's I Dream of Alan Perez. But, you know, I got a lot of respect for what Tim and Dave do. You know, the one guy was, they're both out of the television industry, and the one guy worked on that spinoff from what was that Tim Allen show with the spinoff with Dave Chappelle called Buddies? And I think the other guy worked on Jersey Shore, where he did all of the best, most sensitive dialogue for Snooki. You know, you got to respect that sort of background and their ability to really ad lib and just make an entertaining podcast. Even if it's not always about cameras, it's still entertaining.
When Jim and Cabe were on the show, I really enjoyed it, but I just felt like they jumped the shark when those new guys joined it.
Yeah, no. You know, I offered to send Dave the Spotmatic ES2 when he couldn't get one that worked. And I think it scared him, you know, the idea of actually having to like take pictures with an ES2 must have been intimidating because he refused all offers for me to send that camera all the way out to California for him to play with.
Yeah, do you know what I really like about that show? It's the enthusiasm. The enthusiasm that John and Gary just put into it. They are really good. They just really sort of you know, put everything they can into it. They're really excited. We should really, you know, mention them more often and support the smaller podcasts a little bit.
I'd be happy if they wanted to, you know, come back on our show and, like, you know, perhaps try to boost their listenership a bit, because I know that it would help them.
Wait, they haven't been on our show. We've had some other podcasters, but I don't think they've been on this show, Anthony.
I thought they had been.
You might be thinking of Classic Lenses podcast. They might have been on that one.
Oh, could be.
Yeah.
But I want to help them, you know. I want to help them to try to build that audience, because, you know, it can be dispiriting to be struggling to it's like a voice in the wilderness where you're putting that podcast out and you really have no idea what your demographics are or if anybody's even listening. So, you know, anything that we can do to help those guys, I really think that we should.
Well, you know, I listened to Tim and Marvin, the last episode they did, and I was really impressed, but the thing that I liked the most was it was really short.
Yeah, they get to the point pretty quickly, don't they? And they really just sort of roll these episodes out.
Well, when you don't have a lot to say, it doesn't take long to say it. I mean, and they do very well with that. So, I mean,
brevity is something I could probably learn from them, because I've been long-winded sometimes. Maybe not having a whole lot to say and being super short could actually help me.
And even though they're in the Writers Guild, I think that they're really on the cutting edge of using ChatGPT to generate those listener emails so that they can have a prodigious email bag. Because it must be kind of lonely to not get emails, and ChatGPT is just there.
I know. I mean, this podcast has so many email from real people I've never had a chance to use any of the AI tools that I've wanted to. But, I mean, we have to keep going from all these humans sending us reader feedback and listener feedback.
I think it might be time to start the real podcast.
That was actually kind of fun.
All right. Hey, Ray is in the waiting room. Big surprise. Long time no talk, man. It's been a while since you've been on the show, right? And we have AJ's back, and we have Eric J's back. And that looks like Rick's in the waiting room. Let me let him in. Rick, is that you? Looks like you're there. There we go.
That is. Sorry it took me so long.
No worries.
That was a different phone or something. It wasn't set up to get in.
Well, you look good. You sound good. Welcome back to the show, Rick.
How's things been?
Everything's been well. I mean, this is actually, I said you've been on the show before, but this is actually the first time you've appeared on the Camerosity podcast. The last time we spoke to you was episode 2, when we had our other moniker, the previous name that we went by, Cocaine and Waffles. You were gracious to join us and give us some credibility on that those early days that inspired us to keep going.
So this is to give me some credibility, I guess.
I don't think we probably have to do this, but as we have grown, and our listenership is far beyond the Facebook group where we originally kind of started soliciting people from. Rick, I mean, I know who you are. I think most people do. Your website was an early inspiration for me. It's helped a lot of people with you know, tinkering with their own cameras, learning how things work, how to fix stuff. You know, you've been involved with the Bright Screens, but maybe, you know, why don't you know, give a quick intro to yourself, what your background is and what you've been up to lately.
Okay. I'm really old, so my background is a long story. I started working on cameras back in the late 70s, probably around 79 or 80, because it turned out I couldn't afford cameras I was interested in if they were in working condition. And so I would buy Contax rangefinders for $35 and then try and figure out how they work so that I could put them together. And that sort of evolved into occasionally doing repair work for other people. I had a friend that owned a camera store, so everything that was no longer in production basically would get sent to me instead of going to the factory repair people. And over the course of two, three, four decades of that, back in those days, there weren't any digital cameras and stuff to keep track of what you were doing. So I would make drawings of the different steps of the job as I was doing it, so that if I encountered the same camera, I could come back and not have to learn it all over again. And around, 20 years ago, it occurred to me that I had quite a lot of drawings accumulated, and they weren't going to be any good to anybody else if nobody else could see them. And they weren't going to be good to me anymore after a while. So I scanned all of them onto a CD and started selling those online. And that eventually turned into a PDF download, that sort of thing. And then the bright screen thing came in when I had a Pentacon 6, and on eBay there was an ad for a split image focusing screen to fit Pentacon 6. And I thought, well, that sounds good. So I bought one. It was one of the Chinese things. And well, it turned out it didn't fit a Pentacon 6. It was like twice the size of a Pentacon 6 screen. And so you had to cut it down yourself. And basically, it was an okay focusing screen, but you had to figure out how to make it fit a camera. So I got that done. And then it occurred to me, yeah, I can do this, but your average photographer is not going to want to deal with that kind of junk. And so I contacted the guy I bought the screens from and started buying them 50 at a time, and then set up cutting fixtures and stuff here so I could make them fit all different kinds of cameras. So that's how I got started in that. And then the end of 2017, there was a company called Bright Screen back in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, up till 2012. And the guy passed away, but he had actually had molds made and things for a really nice screen. I first learned about it about a year or two after he had died and started buying his old stock from his widow. And that ran out at the end of 2017. And it turned out she had the mold sitting in her garage that was made in Japan and had been shipped over to the U.S. and just sat in her garage. And so I bought the mold and moved it up to a molding shop in Ohio, because I'm a plastics engineer for a day job, or used to be when I had a day job. So we got it set up. We didn't know if the mold would run or not. Opened it up, and it was in really nice condition. Had spare inserts and really nice shape, except it ran on Japanese power. So put it in production. And that was, I got permission to use the Bright Screen name for it, since it was the same product anyway. And that's where the Bright Screen project came from. And the idea was, when I retired, this was going to be a nice little sort of retirement hobby, pastime business, maybe one screen a day, something like that, be a comfortable load. And then right after I retired, COVID hit, and everybody in the world started digging their old cameras out of their closets. And the one screen a day turned into two, and then it turned into three and four and five. Some days I was getting 10 or 15 orders. That was just too much like work. 2 years ago, almost exactly, April last of 2022, I had been looking for a way to, I won't say get rid of it. I wanted the thing to keep going, but I wanted to keep going beyond when I was going, which I had pretty much reached that point. I was concerned because how many people know enough about cameras and also know enough about plastic molding and optics and all the things that you really need to do to make something like that successfully. And it turned out that an engineer at the plastic molding shop where I was actually molding the parts was really interested in taking this thing over. And so I had to teach him the cutting part. I have a little CNC machine in my garage that was doing the engraving and the cutting and stuff. So he had to come down here for some training sessions, taught him how to do all that stuff, and then handed over to him my CNC machine, all my cutting templates, all my scribing templates, and all the computer files, everything for the instructions and all that stuff. Handed it all over to him. And he drove back home and started doing them himself in about the end of April of 2022. And I stay in touch with him for tech support whenever he has a question about, you know, a camera that he hasn't encountered before, or somebody, a customer comes back and asks a strange question. I'm there for those things. As far as actually making the screens, filling the orders, everything that's involved in running that now is done by a guy named Lance Clark in Ohio, and he is 40 years younger than I am, almost to the day. And so I think the Bright Screens are going to be around for as long as anybody needs them. He's made improvements to the manufacturing process. Right at the time that I handed it over to him, we added another screen to the line. So we started out, it was just a microprism center, and then we had added a combination split image microprism. And then this third one that we added in 2022 is just an all matte screen.
Rick Lance is a great guy. I bought a couple of screens from him, and we had long conversations. And you're aware of what he did with the new Hasselblad screen.
Yes, yes. We worked together on that.
That was one of the biggest bugaboos with putting one of your screens in a Hasselblad was getting it shimmed correctly. And yes. What they did, I don't know, was it you and he together probably figured out exactly what the tolerances were and made a frame that actually drops right into the Hasselblad. And it's dead square perfect. I mean, I've done three of them so far, and they've all been right on.
We did some experimenting with that, and I just hated the Hasselblad because that frame was difficult to work with, and they weren't all alike. I think Hasselblad made at least three different frame designs that went into that series of cameras, and what the screen had to be would be different depending on which frame the person happened to have, and I didn't have a way to tell them apart. So the idea of just getting rid of the frame and making our own spacers and making the thing fit so that you didn't need the frame anymore just made everybody's lives a lot easier.
So, Rick, I never thought about this before. So the screens themselves are injection molded. And then is the microprism like etched in, or is that actually part of the mold as well?
That's all part of the mold.
Oh, wow.
If anything happens to that mold, we're done, because I don't know of any company in the United States that's even capable of making a mold like that. A mold was made in Japan in 1984. We found a company in South Korea that was capable of making that kind of a mold. But they had all we were looking for was a replacement insert for one side of the cavity. And the minimum possible charge was $55,000. There's no way that we would ever be able to redeem that kind of a cost. So, you know, we have what we have. There are the A side is the matte side that you focus on. We have one insert for each of the three screen types, one for the microprism, one for the split image, one for the all matte. Those are interchangeable in the mold. Then on the B side, that's where the Fresnel lens is. And that thing is a mirror-polished, chrome-plated, it's not steel, I think it's probably beryllium copper, duplicate of what that surface of the screen looks like, all optically polished. And we have three, I think maybe four, but I'm sure we have three of those B-side inserts. And they do wear out. We've got one other that actually has been worn out in the molding process by the original Bright Screen people. So they must have made a heck of a lot of those screens back when they were producing them. Of course, back in those days, in the 80s, 90s, these cameras were all current. And they were in full production as a business.
Rick, the Bright Screens, were the Bright Screens and the Beatty Screens both came out of Tennessee, didn't they?
The Bright Screen guy was in near Chattanooga.
Right.
I think are a different thing. They are were a subsidiary of Reflexite Corporation, which does other kind of optical plastic things. And I've dealt with them in the past. I used to design fire helmets, and they made the retroreflective stickers that go on fire helmets for visibility. And those are an optical molding job in itself. But that, I believe, is a completely different operation from the Bright Screen.
Well, the Beatty Intense Screens.
Yeah.
They weren't they out of Tennessee also, though?
I do not know, honestly.
Okay. I was a Beatty dealer, and I'm pretty sure it surprised me that both of them were in out of Tennessee. And I think what it was that one of the principals of the company had worked for Olin Mills, who were based in Chattanooga. I think that's where the connection was, and they because they were sort of competitors. Ray, do you remember?
Yeah.
Ray is old as I am, so he probably was a Beatty dealer also.
We were, and that was, you know, the time that I was in retail, in professional retail, it was nothing but Beatty. That was the only name in town. Rick, I'm from the Boston, New England area. I basically grew up in camera stores. I'm more like Paul's younger brother. I'm not the same age as him, but kindred heart for sure. And I'm looking on the web. Beatty still has a website up and current by the looks of it.
They do have a website, but looking at it closely, it looked like everything turns into a dead link when you start trying to click through.
It looks like it's in a different language completely, too. So, okay, who's to say?
It was Nord Systems or somebody, I think, at the very end.
I think it was Nord Systems. You're right.
Yeah. Rick, are you in Lexington?
I am, yeah.
You came to a camera show. I met you at a camera show in Cincinnati 10 years or so ago.
I get to those when I can, but it's been a while now since I've been to one.
Well, come to the one in Westchester on Saturday, because Mike and I are both going to be there.
Well.
And Ray's going to be there, too.
I'm hoping to get there. I don't know if I'll be able to or not. Depends on some kind of family things going on.
Well, we'd love to see you. I mean, it'd be great to have you.
Theo, it sounds like our invites got lost in the mail.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say. mind you, it's a bit of a flight for me. So.
Yeah, Theo, if you want to come to Cincinnati any time of year, I will drive there to meet you.
Rick, I've got a question for you. The people on this call have all been using cameras for a while and collect them and so on. So they know why a Fresnel screen makes it brighter and why you end up with a brighter screen. But exactly how does that work is probably a question some people may be asking, is why does it make your screen brighter? Why does it make visibility so much better?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people assume, and it's a reasonable assumption, people assume that with a bright screen, more light actually passes through the screen than if you had a regular plain ground glass. So that's not the case. The same amount of light is going through the screen. It's about 92% gets through to the other side. The difference is, and I have a diagram of this that I sketched out. I don't remember if it's on my website. I know I put it on my Flickr pages. If you were to look there in the camera repair section, but the light that hits a ground glass coming from the camera taking lens, if you consider the diaphragm of the taking lens as a single point, the light is coming out in a cone shape. And the light that's right in the center of the screen is coming pretty much straight towards your eye because it's all a straight line. But the light that's going out towards the sides of the screen is not headed towards your eye. It's headed out towards the sides of your viewfinder hood into areas where it's going to be lost. When it hits the screen, the ground glass surface scatters that light to make a focusing image. But most of the light still continues to pass through in the direction that it started. You see an image in the outer areas, but you're only seeing the small amount that happened to be scattered towards your eye, and the rest of it is all lost. So you can lose 90-95% of the light by the time you get out to the corners of a screen. That's why a normal ground glass doesn't just look dim. It looks bright in the center, and it just fades to blackness around the corners. And actually, right in the center is probably as bright as any bright screen. But what the Fresnel lens does is it's basically the same thing as a plano convex lens. It's just cut up into little slices, but it's a condensing lens, and it takes those rays of light that are headed out towards the side, and it bends them back straight again, back towards your eye, so that when you look at the light that's coming through the ground glass surface and then through the Fresnel surface, now, because of the Fresnel lens, it's not going out away from your eye anymore. The main beam of light is headed towards your eye. And it's all uniform because it's bent a little bit different amount at each section of the lens out towards the corner so that all of them are focused back towards you. And that's what makes a bright screen bright. The other trick to that is that your focusing screen now has a focal length of its own, because that Fresnel lens is a condensing lens of a particular focal length. And there's a relationship between that focal length and the focal length, or at least the back focus distance of your camera lens that you're viewing through. So if you have, say, a 35 millimeter camera, you've got maybe what is it, a 50 millimeter normal lens and maybe a 40 millimeter back focus. So as the screen sees the light, it's all coming from the point of a cone 40 millimeters away from the screen. To straighten that out, you want a Fresnel lens on that screen of about 40 millimeters focal length to collimate that beam back toward into a straight line back towards your eye. But if you put that focal length of a Fresnel lens onto a medium format camera, where you've got an 80 millimeter lens and maybe 60 millimeters of back focus, now that's going to be too much. The rays are not going to come towards your eye. They're going to cross halfway to your eye, and they're going to go back out into the edges of the hood again. And so by specifying the Fresnel lens wrong, it's possible to end up with a screen that's every bit as dim and behaves very similarly to a plain ground glass. And that's why a lot of times people ask, can I cut a screen to fit a 35 millimeter camera? I want one for a Nikon or a Xacta or whatever. Yes, I can cut a screen to fit that camera, but it's going to be a bad screen. It's not going to perform. It'll perform better than a regular ground glass. My focal length will be too long for the application that you have, but it will not be an acceptably bright screen by most people's standards if you cut it down and put it in a 35 millimeter camera.
Oh, okay. Because I always thought it was just the sizes that needed to go in there, and the bright screen pretty did its magic. But it's also dependent on the actual focal length as well. That's actually quite interesting.
Why doesn't it change though when you swap lenses? Wouldn't like your screen still work whether it's wide angle or telephoto?
Well,
right?
Because with a single lens reflex, your wide angle lenses are retrofocus lenses. Your telephotos are telephoto lenses. They're all optically adjusted to suit that flange distance that they're mounted on. And so that evens everything out pretty well. The bright screen is a bit of a compromise because I only have the one mold, and we will cut screens for anything from 4x4 up to 6x7 centimeter format. And it works well at all those sizes, but it's optimal in the 6x6 to 6x7 range. And as we cut it smaller for 6.45 and 4x4, it's not as well matched on those cameras as it is. Well, the 6.45 is pretty much the same because it's still a 75 millimeter lens, but you get down to a 60 millimeter lens on a 4x4, and we're pushing the screen about as small as it wants to be pushed.
And also now I see that you've got, there are some 4x5 screens.
We do have some 4x5 screens. We do not have the mold for those. I bought all the old stock that Bright Screen had remaining. And I don't remember if it was 500,000 screens, something like that. It's a pretty good number of screens. But when those are gone, they're gone. We don't have the mold to remake those.
They're always a problem when you go to replace any ground glass on a 4x5 because the tolerances are so tight that the screen has to fit in exactly the same location that a piece of film will be in when the film holder goes in.
It is. And it's such a complex situation because when you put the film holder in, or the screen moves, and you've got a box full of film holders, and it has to match all those. And it's a tough nut. And the other thing is, on a large format camera, they all tend to be kind of their own animal. They weren't mass produced in the same sense that SLRs and TLRs were. And so, it's more of an individual installation challenge in a 4x5. We can't as easily write a set of drop-in replacement instructions for you.
Yeah, well, your instructions for replacing screens is great. It's just, you know, when you get into the large format, it's one of the most tedious things you can ever do. Is I hated it when I broke a ground glass on a camera because it just took so long to get it dialed in, to get the ground glass in the right position. It's not just a matter of tightening four screws and going.
And you don't know exactly where the film is. It's not like you can just lay a ground glass across your film rails like you do in a roll film camera, because there aren't any.
Or even a piece of wax paper. I mean, you can do it quick and dirty to check a small camera, but not a 4x5.
Yeah.
I've used a huge number of SLRs and TLRs over the years, from 1930s Exactas to, you know, the newest Nikons and such. And you can definitely see the progression of like technology and focusing screens, even in 35 millimeter, you know, even as recently as the 50s, an Exacta would usually have just a plain piece of ground glass. I have an Alpa, and it's very dark. I mean, you can see the vignetting even at 35 millimeter. And then the Fresnel pattern, the circular pattern came out, and that improved things dramatically. But I noticed by the like mid 70s into the early 80s, screens continued to get better. You compare the screen of a Nikon F5 to an F2, and it's day and night difference, even though the F2 is still very good. But I noticed you can no longer see that circular pattern anymore. My question is that circular pattern there just so small you no longer notice it, or do they come up with a different way to do it by like mid 70s, early 80s?
Well, there's a few possibilities. I think the two basic tricks to that is that first, they are extremely fine in those cameras. The second thing is that typically they will put the Fresnel surface on the bottom of the screen between the lens and the focusing surface. And so your matte focusing surface will blur your view of those lines a little bit, so it makes them a little bit less visible. I don't like doing that as a general practice, because it's an optical component between the lens and the screen, which does not exist between the lens and the film. And so for a optically optimal condition, I like to have nothing between the focusing surface of the screen and the camera lens. The downside of my version is that now the Fresnel rings are on top and you see them.
Yeah, I don't mind seeing the circles. I don't necessarily think they're distracting. It seemed like when they disappeared, things got even brighter than ever before. You take a look at a 1960s Zeiss Icon Contiflex, the SLRs, and the circles are so prominent. There's almost like a dark circle in between each bright circle. But then, you know, like I said, as the years went on, you could continue to see them getting smaller and smaller and smaller until they're almost not there anymore. But that makes sense that they're slightly out of phase with the focal point, thus blurring them a little bit.
I was going to say, I don't know if getting rid of those rings is actually a bad, you know, a good thing, because think about everybody that says looking through a TLR is fantastic because you're looking at it down and it's almost like you're looking into another world and it's nice. I think part of it is the fact that you can see those rings. Otherwise, you're looking at basically the same as a phone screen. So I'm there with Rick on that one. I prefer to see the rings because it actually does give you that differentiation.
The Leica Flex cameras, any of them that used an aerial image, were more difficult to focus because they didn't have anything that was assisting you in doing it.
Right, only the center.
But what Mike is saying about the improvements, there were other improvements too that went along with it. And that was, you know, the improvements in production of prisms and improvements in front surface mirrors. So you add all that stuff together, and there were tremendous improvements from probably the early to mid 70s.
There's one really major change that came in with autofocus cameras, and I believe Minolta did it, and Minolta makes the screens for Hasselblad, as far as I can recall. And that change is not on the Fresnel side. It's on the focusing side of the screen. All the autofocus cameras have it. And I have some microscopic photos of some screens, again, on my Flickr pages to show what the difference is. But the bright screen is state-of-the-art technology from, say, 1980, before these things came along. It's the matte side of the Fresnel side is a good quality Fresnel, fairly fine. The matte side is a random matte textured surface, such as you would have had on a ground glass or in the 1970s. But what Minolta did, and what now everyone does with autofocusing screens, is that matte surface is not a random textured surface anymore. What it is an array of very, very tiny microscopic convex lenses across the entire screen. and it creates the appearance of what looks like a matte surface. But it has an upside and a downside. Each of these little micro lenses has a focal length and it has an effective aperture. And since cameras today generally come with something like an f5.6 kit zoom lens, you'd never see f1.4 lenses on cameras anymore. These little micro lenses are designed to gather all their light from that central f5.6 circle in the zoom lens.
That's and interesting.
What that does is it makes them optimally bright for that slower lens. And if you were to take an f5.6 lens and put it on your Nikon F, you would find that it's a much dimmer view than what you get when you put it on an autofocus camera. But if you are manually focusing and you put an F1.2 Nikkor onto your autofocus camera and you open it up wide all the way to F1.2, you've got a focusing screen that is still only looking at the central F5.6 circle in the middle of that.
I have wondered that before.
You can focus accurately as long as you stay at small apertures from 5.6 down to 22. But when you start to open that lens up to F2.8, F2, F1.4, F1.2, you are not seeing the depth of field that your film is seeing. You're still seeing an F5.6 view, and it becomes totally possible to manually focus.
And it doesn't even really dramatically improve the brightness, too. You know, the old theory of you put a slow lens on an old SLR, you're going to have a dim viewfinder. You put a fast lens on it. That's why the Canon Pelex that had the pellicle mirror that took away some of the brightness. They introduced a new F1.2 lens to hopefully combat some of that. I have an old Contax D that has a Tessar 40 millimeter F4.5 lens. It's just a normal screw mount, but the maximum aperture is F4.5. And you put this on anything and it's dim. It's incredibly dim. And yet you can go get a cheap Nikon. What's the consumer, the D5300? I don't know what the consumer DSLRs are, but those come with 18 to 55 millimeter kit zooms with a maximum aperture of 3.5 or 4 or something like that. And they're super bright. So what you're saying is that they're drawing their brightness from that dead center instead of more of an average, like maybe the older ones were. That makes perfect sense. And then
that's correct.
Yeah. And then you put an F1.4 on there. In addition to what you said, you're not benefiting from the depth of field as much. But in my opinion, it's only marginally brighter. I mean, you would think going from a 3.5 kit zoom to an F1.4 prime on a modern, you know, DSLR or anything would be game changing. But it almost doesn't even look like it's much better.
That's the thing. You're not getting any of the extra light from a lens on that camera. It's taking it all out of the central, say, F4.
That was one of the problems with the autofocus cameras was that they were really not designed to be used as manual focus cameras.
No.
And of course you lost your split image. And what you had was the electronic rangefinder, which was good in some ways and not so good in other ways.
Yeah. I mean, I would have never, I mean, Rick, I obviously knew there was something that went into these bright screens. There was some technology, but I mean, even though I've spoken to you before, I've never at all realized how much technology is involved in this stuff with them having their own, you know, focal lengths and apertures and such like that. That's super interesting.
I have in the DSLRs, I've got two Canons. They're both Rebels because I don't like the size and weight of the better ones. And one of them, I've replaced the focusing screen with a split image manual focus screen so that I could use my old faster lenses on it. And then the other one I've just left in its original condition to use the autofocus lenses on. And that works well for me.
Well, on the current digital cameras, like the mirrorless cameras, I've been playing around with a new one, which involves some high speed lenses, like a 75 millimeter 1.2. And to use them, you have to use them manually, of course, they're manual focus. But the electronic focus really doesn't work until you stop it down to f5.6 or so. You physically can't, you can't see the pattern that comes up to show you that you're in focus.
The mirrorless, of course, is a different animal. It doesn't have a focusing screen in it. So you're actually viewing an electronic viewfinder fed off the sensor. So they have their own challenges and issues.
Now, Paul, are you saying they're using focus peaking?
Yes.
And it's still giving you problems?
Yeah, at wide open. If I stop it down to F5.6, if I underexpose to make the finder darker, I can get the focus nail. But then if I want to shoot at a wider aperture, I have to reopen it, which is not a big deal. I mean, I'm not shooting anything. It's moving real fast.
I play around with, I have both of the Canon 0.95 50s. Uh-huh. And I don't seem to have a problem.
On which camera are you?
Sony, Nikon, Canons, Olympus. I've picked a camera and I own it.
Well, I'm trying it on the Leica M10Rs.
Okay, that's, yeah.
They're, you know, the Chinese high-speed lenses.
You don't want to use that cheap stuff.
It's a failure, believe me. I on the Sonys and the Fujis, which I also use, I don't seem to be having the same issues. But on the M10R, the electronic viewfinder just simply doesn't like it until it gets a little bit underexposed.
That's what I'm thinking, Paul. I think the technology there that, you know, the other brands, the Asian brands have, might just be a little bit more sensitive coming from the video market than what Leica is doing right now.
Well, isn't it true some of the TT Artisan, or maybe it's a 7 Artisan, I can't remember, don't they give you adjustment screws in the box when you buy them because they're not calibrated?
A few of them, not all. The wides don't have to be, but
but some of them are, though, right?
1.1, definitely.
Yeah.
The 7 Artisans need to be calibrated more than the TTs do. And the light lens lenses don't need to be calibrated at all. They're all calibrated at the factory.
Light lab lens, I think, are quite the step above the TTs and the other.
Yes.
The breakdown of the Artisans.
Yeah, I had to calibrate I had a 51.1 7 Artisans that I had to calibrate. And it was easy. I mean, it was nothing to do it, but it needed to be done. But then I got a 28.56 that did not need to be calibrated. It was right out of the box. It was perfect.
So Rick, you had commented, you've been out of the bright screens for 2 years. Your replacement was a guy 4 decades younger than you, but it sounds to me like the molds may be the death of the industry, not necessarily the people. Is there any hope that anything could be made? I know you said the South Korean company came up as an option, but is there any hope for these molds to be recreated for, 20 years down the road or something?
As a practical matter, I don't really think so. If it really only comes down ultimately to money,
right?
But the market is not big enough anymore to generate the kind of money that it would take to build one of these molds in today's costs. You know, on the upside, I don't believe these molds are going to wear out in 20 years. I've been running this mold for 5-6 years and seen no sign of any kind of aging or wear on it at all. You know, unless the market gets bigger than it is now, which frankly I don't see happening.
No.
I just can't see that this mold is going to wear out. I can't imagine how many shots it had on it, on that one insert,
right,
that worn out. So we see no sign of any kind of wear like that.
Hey, Jay, did you have a question earlier?
Yeah, no, it's because we're talking about Fresnels, and I've got one for my 4x5. I just don't know whether I should put it on or not, or how to put it on. I'm going to have to check in and see how to install it on a 4x5.
Well, it goes on the inside. It goes between the lens and the ground glass.
Well, do you need like shims for it, though? Like,
it's
to get it
on the inside?
In the case of a bright screen, the screen is the Fresnel and the ground glass. It doesn't use a separate ground glass. The trick that you need to do if you're installing a bright screen is just to make sure that the focusing side of the screen is in the exact same position that it was in with your old ground glass.
So you're saying I replace ground glass with the Fresnel?
Well, now yours isn't a bright screen, is it, AJ? That's just a Fresnel lens.
Yeah, this is a Fresnel lens.
Yeah, so if you just have the Fresnel lens, what I would do is install it on the side of the ground glass towards your eye.
Okay.
It will not affect the distance between the ground glass and the lens. That's what is going to create your focus accuracy.
Okay.
You can put anything you like between the ground glass and your eye without hurting your image.
Okay.
When you put it on the other side, then you've changed the distance.
Yeah.
From the film to produce
that optical piece of optical material with its thickness and its focal length and everything into your light path. And it's possible to adjust that back out, but it's a real pain in the butt.
And the Fresnel side is towards my eye, the textured side.
Either way.
Oh, it doesn't matter?
As long as it's not in the way of your light path lens to the ground glass, you can do what you like. I would put it with the polished side towards your eye.
Yeah.
Because then the grooves are protected from damage.
Where?
And if something does happen to it, you can polish it back out with Simichrome and you still got a screen. Okay. You put it the other way and something happens to those grooves, you're going to have to live with it because there's no way you can repair that.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's funny you mentioned that because I'm borrowing a Leica M8 from Paul that he got from someone else. And I looked at the viewfinder, there were these two vertical lines going right through. At first I thought the prism was bad. I'm like, there's no way Paul would have sent this to me with two black stripes going through the prism. But he said that the guy he got them from was a portrait photographer, and he had taken like a woman's mascara, those pencils that it's like, it's not lead, but it's like wax.
Mm-hmm. It's a wax pencil.
Yeah. He took a wax pencil and drew two vertical lines on either side of the ground glass, obviously on the shiny side, to approximate, what was it? 8x10, you think?
Yeah. Yeah. He was a wedding guy. And so, you know, wedding brides want 8x10s. I mean, that's what frames are. Frames are 8x10. Since a 35mm negative makes you an 8x12 or a 7x10, he just put the lines on so he could frame a little more accurately so his lab would know what to do.
Yeah, they do that back in the old wet plate days when you have the big ground glass. And a lot of times I'd be using the reducing backs to get several different, you know, shots on one plate because plates were expensive. So the photographer would, now it's just a regular ground glass back then, they would take a pencil and mark on the rough side of the ground glass, and you can get different format sizes, or they'd put like an ellipse where the portrait head would be to get the head centered or something. And the cool part about that is now I've marked up my period ground glasses on my old cameras like that. And the cool part is it's non-destructive, because if you want to take it off, just take a little napkin with some alcohol on it and it comes off like nothing ever happened.
That's the wonderful thing about glass.
One more quick question, Rick. On the old ground glass that I had, because I changed it for a graphic one, the old one had some felt on the shiny edge of the ground glass. Should I put a spacer also with the new one, or should I just put it flat against it?
Were those little pieces, are they facing towards the lens?
No, they're facing towards my eye.
And it doesn't matter.
No, but do I need a space between the Fresnel and the ground glass, or does it matter?
It's not critical. If you have two glossy surfaces together,
yeah,
and you put them right together, you'll get Newton rings off those two gloss surfaces in contact, and you get funny little rainbows and stuff. Doesn't do any harm. It can be distracting.
All right, okay.
If you're putting it with the grooves towards the shiny side of the ground glass or towards the matte side of the ground glass, there's not anything like that going to happen. It doesn't hurt to have spacers there, but they shouldn't be necessary.
They shouldn't be necessary. Okay. Thank you very much.
So Rick, you know, obviously you're well known in addition for your drawings you had mentioned earlier. I know that's honestly probably how I discovered you when I first started collecting, because you have some excellent drawings on how to take apart the Arga C3. And that was one of the first cameras I had ever repaired myself. Do you still repair people's cameras now, or are you still just kind of doing it for fun? Or like, what have you been up to since you've stopped being in the day-to-day operation of the bright screens?
I have a 50-year-old Mercedes Benz that I try to persuade to start with varying degrees of success. So that gives me something to do with some of my time. I've actually been trying my hand at repairing watches lately, and that I don't know that I'm ever going to make that happen. And my real problem with it is the same as the problem I'm encountering anymore with cameras, only on a worse scale. And that's that my hands shake. I have a hard time working on really small things because I am having a harder time holding my hand steady. Even drawing is much more of a challenge than it used to be. So I still do that stuff. I never do it for other people because I just can't trust myself to be able to complete something successfully anymore. But I still like to tinker with stuff. So I'm volunteering at an aviation museum here in Lexington, and found out about a year ago that they had a 1909 Gnome rotary engine from a pre-World War I airplane. I managed to talk them into letting me take a hand at fixing that up and preparing it for museum display. So that gave me something to do from about August until Thanksgiving of last year. The rotary engines are really neat. If you're into engines, I don't know, but back before World War I, airplanes were so slow that an air-cooled engine didn't get enough air to cool it. And water-cooled were so heavy that they weren't real practical with the low amount of power they could produce. And so this guy came up with the idea of what looks like what would be today a radial engine, but the entire engine spins with a propeller. So all seven cylinders are spinning around in the air behind the propeller. And the only thing it doesn't turn is the crankshaft. And they make a really interesting sort of engine. They were dominant during World War I, and then they disappeared after the First World War when airplanes had gotten too big for them. But I got to rebuild one of those a little bit. I've got some machine tools in the garage, so I play with stuff like that. I can still do things that involve computer-controlled machining pretty well. So I have a little tiny milling machine and a laser. I did some experiments. I was thinking about reverse engineering discontinued camera parts for repair services and making computer models and then having the parts either 3D printed or machined or whatever. That got less entertaining as time went on. So I'm planning on wrapping that kind of stuff up during the course of this year and just kind of catching up on my naps.
Well, your website is one of the greatest. I mean, I could spend hours at your website.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just it is so full of interesting stuff. It's not just photo. I mean, it's like an encyclopedia of cool stuff. And we'll post a link to that.
A lot of that's pretty old now. I haven't been putting a whole lot of work into maintaining my website, but
you may not be putting new content in it, but I mean, you're talking about stuff that's interesting and things that people will still like to see. So it's definitely a public service.
I kind of like the how stuff works ideas. I did a series on different kinds of camera shutters, and then I did one on how lens coding works and how bright screens work and how rangefinders work and things like that. Just things that people know it's out there, but they don't necessarily have any kind of a sense of, well, why would this do what it does?
You know, speaking of your website, earlier today, in fact, I had an email exchange through my site with a guy named Donald DeNaro, and he said he used to write for Camera Shopper back in the day. And, you know, he used to have a lot of articles on how things worked and everything. He's a old electrical engineer, something along those lines, but he made the comment that the internet has buried everything. And while that's not technically, you know, the internet's fault, it's just the way things work is that information is only relevant for a short period of time. And in the paper days, you had a book, that book, assuming it wasn't destroyed, would continue to provide information for as long as the book physically exists. And that's no longer true in the digital era. You know, I mean, we're all film enthusiasts here. And part of the appeal of film that most people will tell you is the permanence of it. You know, negatives and the images that we make are tactile. They can survive for as long as you're willing to keep them. You know, we talked the last episode about Dan's, you know, glass plates that he's collecting from Amish villages. And we're seeing them now. You scan those old glass plates and tintypes and such in, the detail is incredible. I mean, we're seeing near medium format digital quality out of images that were taken over 100 years ago. But as the years go by, and the early digital era from, let's say, the 90s, 2000s, eventually the 2010s, that stuff's going to disappear. And there's so many websites that have gone down and have, and that information's lost. And I talked about, there was a Dresden camera website. I can't remember the name of the guy who did it, but he recently took it offline. There's so many websites that are just gone. There was a MirandaCamera.com had a really good database to help you identify which Miranda SLR you have. And I mean, you could still see some of that stuff through the Wayback Machine. There's archives of internet, but they're really difficult. They're slow. A lot of times those archives lose the images and you only get the text with a whole bunch of broken links. So you lose that stuff too. And, you know, I just think it's important to try and retain this information and share it in some way, you know, so that it's not lost. So, you know, Rick, even though you said you haven't updated it in quite a while, that information is still good. You know, I mean, a Topcon RE Super from the 60s isn't going to change. So, or an Argus C3. So anything you've written, hopefully there's you have a contingency plan to keep that information up when that day comes that you go to the great shutter in the sky.
I was just looking over his website, and one of the best parts is the tips for photographers. A product that I'm not sure anyone has ever marketed, but today would make a great deal of sense. It's for brass paint. So if you have a black camera, you know, if you have a black paint camera, you no longer have to use it in order to show wear. Just buy some brass paint and paint your black paint camera.
Rick, I'm looking at your site here too. Is that the Mercedes you're talking about? The red that's a beautiful car. The 450 SL.
I bought it on eBay.
Oh, wow. That is gorgeous.
Is it a diesel or petrol?
It's a gasoline. It's a V8, single overhead cam V8, 276 cubic inches. The engine is as big as a 454 Chevy, I think, in bulk. It's just a massive thing. There's no room under that hood at all. You couldn't drop a nickel and have it hit the ground in there. And we've been living together for about 12 years now. It's been mostly good. There's been a few major bads, but I had to, 2015, I had to rebuild or sort of replace the electronic fuel injection in it because it quit and there was nobody still left alive that knew how to fix it. And there's nobody's got enough money to pay the parts. So I redid that with a modern mega squirt fuel injection system in it, which right now will not start. I still have to have that conversation with the car this spring as soon as the weather gets a little better. We had snow flurries today.
Yeah, same here. I'm north of you, though, so I would expect a little bit more, but not in Kentucky.
It's a full-on winter storm where I am.
Tim's in the UP.
Just about as far north as you can get in the country.
Rick, we do have actually, I just, before we sort of move on to other topics and so on, we did have one listener question that came through on the Facebook group. And I think you've sort of answered it already because of the answer on the molds, but it was from Mark Beadle. And he said, if there's a possibility of making screens with angled split prisms for the Kiev 88 CM, you know, angled rather than split.
The 45 cross. Degree. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm imagining if there's no more molds that you can't really sort of do that.
The bright screen, we had to choose since they said we only had one mold. So we decided to make our split diagonal. There's a number of reasons for that. One is that some cameras want the screen to be cut on the vertical axis and some want it to be cut on the horizontal axis. And if we made it horizontal, there'd be some cameras that came out vertical and that wouldn't work very well.
Oh, okay.
So we made it diagonal. So which Kiev were you asking about?
The Kiev 88 CM. So that's the Hasselblazky.
Does that take the same screen as the original Hasselblad 1000F? The camera is basically a copy.
It might. I really don't know.
It probably does, or it's damn close.
We do make bright screens for the 1000F Hasselblad. And so if the key of 88 is the same, that would just fit. If it's different, I'm sure we can make a screen for it. Nobody, frankly, has ever asked.
Okay.
We need somebody to get a camera.
It's usually, I've actually got one here, but it's like the usual ones. Probably the reason why no one's ever asked is because they generally just don't work.
Well, that's the same with Hasselblads for the most part, too.
I've got a Kiev 88 right here. I don't know how to...
Yeah, that's exactly like mine, yes.
I don't know how to check to see, but the basic body is very Hasselblad 500-esque. So the Soviet Union wasn't known for changing things for the sake of changing things. They would only modify when necessary.
The camera is basically a copy of the 1000F, which was before the 500C. Focal plane shutter.
I would be willing to bet it would work.
I would just about guess that if you took a Hasselblad screen, which is just a 56 millimeter square screen, there's nothing exotic about it. It's a very simple square shape. I expect it would drop in and install just the same way in the Kiev 88. You do have to make sure that you get the focus, get the position set right for focus. I believe they have little spring-loaded adjustable supports on that screen, so you'd have to tweak it in when you change it.
Well, Rick, if you think you could make it to Cincinnati on Saturday, I'd be happy to bring this for you to inspect, and maybe you'll have one customer getting you a new focus screen.
Hang on just a second. Let me take a quick look at my calendar. I do not remember. I was planning on getting up there, and then some family things have been sneaking in around the edges, and
it's okay. I was half joking, but I mean, if you think you're gonna
get there or not, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's fine. It's totally fine. I don't get to Cincinnati all that often. I've been to the show once before. I have an uncle that lives there too, so I'm gonna stop by and visit with him for a short while. But you know, it's not too far of a drive from me. It's about 4 hours from where I'm at now, so I'm kind of looking forward to going down there. In fact, I was at today, at the last 2 days, I've been going through my storage unit, filling boxes and what to bring. I know, Paul, you've been sorting through your stuff. Ray, you said you already filled up your car, but I'm up to 13 boxes. And I think I've reached the limit of what I can fit in my Subaru Outback. So I do have one box of free stuff. So these shows usually have a free table. So I'll have a few like random accessories, some box cameras that there's nothing wrong with them. I just, they're not even worth my time to try and sell. So I'll throw a box full of some freebies up there too. Paul's been sharing some of the stuff he's going to bring. You got, what are some of the highlights, Paul, that you're going to be bringing?
I'm bringing a Cardin, and
there you go. Mm-hmm. The civilian one, right?
Yeah. The civilian model. Yep. And I've also got, oh man, I've got so much stuff. I'm going to bring a collection of 1950s vintage TLRs. I probably got 30 different cameras with 30 different models.
What a coincidence. I have about 3 boxes of 1950s TLRs.
Well, bring them. We'll compare.
Oh, they're coming.
You know, while we're talking here, 5 minutes ago, I sold a Ward Flex.
I got one of those.
Well, you know, I got $150 for this one. Really? I should be careful. The guy that bought it may listen to this.
Yeah, but my prices are way below that. I do. There is one though that I'm half about. I don't know if I want to bring it, but I just don't have room for it. But it's very cool. Maybe one of the listeners would be interested in this. I have a Conaflex, not the huge one. It's a Konica's one and only 6x6 120 TLR. It kind of looks like just any other like cord, you know, Japanese style TLR, but it has interchangeable lenses. Konica only made one 6x6 TLR, and I have one in the original box. I mean, it's in great shape, and I'm gonna bring that and see if maybe somebody wants that. But not all of the TLRs I'm bringing are that interesting. I found at least 4 brilliants. So I'll have the see who's gonna out brilliant the other.
I've got 5 of them. I'm brilliant.
Oh, I only have
between,
4.
We were gonna completely ruin the market on Voigtlander brilliants. Brillance.
I think you guys could make up, if you build a large chessboard, you could make up a game completely with TLRs for all the men.
Yeah.
Well, one of the Prairie Lance I have has the is the Italian model.
Okay.
That, you know, because they sold them in different countries in Europe. Yep.
They came in Spanish.
Gruppo, G-R-U-P-P-O on the lens rather than whatever it would have said in German.
How do you say brillant in Italian?
Brillant.
Brillant! It's me, Mario!
I say it loud.
We've probably just lost all our Italian listeners, but
we're
anyway.
Racist. Phil and Tim from I Dream of Photography podcast are going to probably nail us for our unappealing ethnic jokes there.
You know what is this where we go into the obligatory Vivian Myers story?
Oh yeah,
I think they had something to say about that, not quite sure what.
Well, I don't think they necessarily didn't like what I said, but it did come up, and I'm actually surprised it took that long. For anybody who doesn't understand what I'm talking about, we were talking about on the Rolly episode, we got on the topic of Vivian Myers, and you know, I thought the whole segment was complimentary. I mean, how could it not be? The lady was an incredible photographer, and those glimpses of Chicago are just priceless. But I had made the comment that, you know, after watching Finding Vivian Myers, the movie, I walked away feeling as though she just came off as a little creepy. You know, somebody that had I known in real life, I would have had to keep a little bit of a side eye on her.
I agree.
Yeah. From a photographic standpoint, though, I mean, fantastic. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. And I like the whole barn find, whether you're talking about cars, old computers, cameras, whatever, but that the whole story about how that guy bought some of these negatives, or I think it was undeveloped rolls from an estate sale, and he only got part of them, and then just started going through them and being blown away by the images that she had shot. And she was unheard of at the time. It's just such a cool story, you know, that almost by accident, you know, had that not occurred, those negatives, I mean, very easily. I mean, how many estates have there been over the course of the past 100 years where there's a whole box of slides or old film from a family and people just throw them away? You know, I mean, there's so many images like that that have been lost that you never know, like, you know, what percentage of those people were very talented photographers. And thankfully we were able to see her work.
Josh and Grant from that podcast have really strong opinions on this.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, well, that's all right, though. Mm. Everybody could have an opinion.
So, Rick, what are there any cameras right now that you'd like to find to work on? Things that
would
be
available? Well, that's a good question.
Because Mike and I happen to have a few extra cameras, and we may have some in our respective storage units.
At this stage of life, I'm not sure that I'm up to it. I have, since the bright screen thing kept me so busy for so long, I have probably 40 or 50 of my own that really are in need of some attention that I haven't got around to. And I'm not sure I'm going to have the nerve to get after all of them by the time I've finished with them. I just had to, my wife had a Pentax K1000 that we bought just around the time we got married. And she had dropped it in a restroom somewhere and smashed the top cover up really badly. And so I thought, well, I've got a parts camera. I'll just switch out, put a new top cover on, and then it'll look pretty again. You can put it back on the shelf. And then I noticed the shutter was kind of hanging at the top speeds, and that thing was disassembled on my desk for probably 3 weeks. So at that pace, by the time I get through the stuff that I have here, I probably will have been dead for about 4 years.
We're talking about donations now. So if there's any parts cameras you need or anything that you've always wanted to work on.
Well, I'll tell you what, if I'm always a sucker for parts donors, I have some tendency to try to turn the parts donors into working stuff just out of spite. So if I do get to Cincinnati, we can have a conversation.
If you come to Cincinnati, I can guarantee you at least a full banker's box full of projects.
Baron,
hang on. I want to revisit that, Rick. Rick, I want to revisit that last statement. If you're putting parts cameras together, have you created any Franken cameras through parts?
Ooh, good question.
Not exactly, but I've done some atrocious things with lenses. I used to have a Calamar Reflex 6x6 SLR. I don't know if you've, it was made by Fujita. I don't know if you ever had one of those. They've seen them, but it's the cheapest or a contender for the cheapest medium format SLR ever made.
Did you see how fast they did that?
There you go. Yeah. Two or three. Yeah, though. Yeah, it's like,
and Paul's got his up as well now.
Now, the thing about that camera is that its lens mount is an M44 by, I think, 3/4 of a millimeter pitch.
It's the same as Miranda's screw mount.
No, Miranda is an M44 by 1 millimeter pitch.
Is it really? Maybe I shouldn't cross-thread it then.
What I did, I can't remember the name of the store, but there's a store on the north side of Chicago just sold junk, darkroom specialists or something like that. They just had bins of junk stuff. I bought a few Miranda screw mount teleconverters from them for like $5 a piece. And then I took valve grinding compound and wiped it on the threads of the male thread of the Miranda teleconverter and just gradually worked it back and forth until I had reshaped the threads on the aluminum teleconverter to screw in all the way into the Miranda or into the Calamar mount. Now I had a teleconverter that was made for a 35 millimeter camera. That wasn't really a whole lot of use to anybody, but I put a T-mount on the front of it. And if you take out the set screws that hold the optics in a teleconverter and you screw the optics forward or back in the body, it moves the focus point forward or back. And so okay. I managed to readjust the Miranda teleconverter so that it became a converter that let me use 35 millimeter T-mount lenses on the Calamar reflex. At the same time that you're doing that, the magnification power of the teleconverter increases. So a 1.5x teleconverter turned into a 2.5x teleconverter. And the side benefit of that was now a 35 millimeter format lens covered the entire 6x6 square in the Calamar. And so then I could put things like a 400 millimeter Spiritone sharpshooter telephoto on the Calamar. Then I could stack two or three more 2x teleconverters on top of that in the T-mount. And I used that to take photographs of a near total eclipse of the sun in 1994. It was a 4,000 millimeter f/63 lens wide open. Ooh. And I the way down to f/320 for the solar eclipse. And then I stuck on whatever filters I could find to try and dim it down some more and still overexposed pretty badly when you're shooting straight at the sun. But I got a series of photographs of a solar eclipse with that turkey.
It's a shame that the Calamar, the Fujitas, the build quality you can tell is a little bit lacking. From a usability standpoint, they're quite nice. If there was a way to get this serviced by somebody who likes to fix things,
I'll send you the repair notes.
Okay. No, I mean, actually, the issue this one has, like you might expect from any unserviced focal plane shutter camera, is it actually works, but the bottom like quarter of the image is very dark. The curtains aren't traveling at the correct speed, and it grossly underexposes the image near the bottom. Well, it'd technically be the top, I guess. But otherwise, I quite enjoyed using it. It's a pretty nice camera. It's like a TLR, but it's an SLR.
Did you know that was designed by Heinz Kilfit?
I did, yes. I found one image of the prototype that looks nothing like it. But if you look at it closely, you can see all the controls in the exact same spot.
Tail. Yeah.
This would have been a Kilfit SLR originally, but they, for whatever, I never found out why they didn't do it. But apparently they either Fujita was involved all along in building it, or the design was sold to them. It's not clear, but yes, you're right.
Now, as far as the shutter springs, though, on the bottom right-hand corner of that camera body, the right-hand side and the bottom rear corner, there's a little metal cover held with a couple of screws.
Yeah, right here.
Right there, that is the shutter curtain spindle tension.
Oh.
So if you want to adjust your curtains, that's where it is. Huh. I wouldn't necessarily recommend going crazy with that without making sure everything's clean and working right first, but it's fairly accessible. The biggest Achilles heel to that camera that I found is the mirror will tend to hang up, particularly if you shoot in cold weather, things like that. To get to the linkage that operates the mirror, you have to take a whole lot of stuff off the right-hand side under that side cover. And there's one other thing. Oh, the shutter cocking. There's one little piece that wears as you cock the shutter. And sooner or later, eventually that'll wear too far, and then it won't catch and it won't stay cocked. And the trick is that if you get a parts camera, it's going to have that same part worn out.
Right.
So you're a little bit stuck when that finally happens. That's kind of an end of life thing.
Well, this one I shot its test roll through. I wrote a review of it. I'm not likely to probably ever use it again, but I'm happy to have it. But this would not be a regular shooter for me, at least.
Yeah, they're pretty neat cameras. I had the 52 millimeter wide angle. The most famous thing about those cameras is that they made the first retrofocus wide angle lens ever made for a format. Hasselblad 1000Fs were buying Calamar wide angles because it was the only way to get a wide angle lens onto a Hasselblad at that time.
Just changing tracks for a moment. I've got a camera here where, Paul, I'm sorry, mate, but you're just going to get so jealous about this. You're never going to recover from this.
Mamiya 7.
No. I bought this June. It's a King Regular 3A. And I know, Paul, that this is like on the top of your list.
I actually have the 3D, which must be better than an A.
They were test scores.
But sorry, Paul. Yeah, I know you've had your eye on these kind of things for a while, but yeah.
Well, you know, we keep talking we're going to do a King Regular episode, and we haven't done it. So
no, we did it already. It's just like 1 minute long because that's about all we know about them.
That would be the whole episode. That actually works, which is another problem.
I have one.
I have two.
What? Working cameras? Working King Regulars?
Yeah.
King Regulars, yes.
Amazing.
Meters aren't working, but shutter fires.
Oh, I've got one with a meter that's working. It's an extinction meter, but it's working.
No, I had two of them. I had the interchangeable lens one, which I think that's the one you have, Theo, right?
I have the D. It has.
That was the one that was dead, but I have one called the RM, which is basically the same body with a meter, rangefinder, but it has a fixed lens, and that one works perfectly. That one works really, really well, and I did a review of it, and great results.
They're good cameras. I mean, they're not a Lortomat by any means.
No.
Or a Lydolf.
Change of subject here on strange cameras. Hang on.
The Continental? I've seen
these things.
I have a review of one of those on my site, the Continental TXL.
I bought this as a joke, and I don't even remember exactly why I bought it, but literally it was $10 on eBay, and I bought it to take it apart, I guess.
The listeners can't see anything you're holding. He's holding a camera called the Continental TXL, which is either Chinese or is it Hong Kong? I mean,
it's just Hong Kong, I think.
Yeah, it's a Hong Kong, probably British Empire era. But I'm sure you're going to say this, but the really cool thing about that, the shutter is very similar to the Yagi EXA.
It is, but there's so much more to it than that. I was just blown away when I took this thing apart. I couldn't understand how it worked, and I'd have to send you to my Flickr pages again to see the disassembly and the explanation of it. But yes, you're right. The shutter is like the shutter in an EXA, but there is no timing system in it. It is, I can't even explain how it works. Instead of like in the EXA, the mirror comes up and it just opens a big hole behind it. And then another blade comes up and closes the hole. The hole is the shape of an inverted V, kind of a triangle with a point at the top. For different shutter speeds, which there are no shutter speeds marked on the camera, there's no control for shutter speeds. There's a control for apertures. It's kind of a program thing. If you set f22, you're going to get a 500th or a 700th of a second shutter speed. If you set f28, you're going to get a 60th of a second shutter speed and a range in between. And the whole difference is the mirror comes up a different distance based on what aperture you've got set, which means that little inverted V gets wider and wider as the mirror goes up farther, but it only goes up farther for larger apertures, and that's what gives you slower shutter speeds. And it's the most bizarre thing that I think I've ever seen, but it actually works. I ran a roll of film through it, and every shot on that roll of film was properly exposed and reasonably decent pictures. It's kind of irritating that somebody can take such a shitty piece of junk and get such good results just because they were clever as hell.
Look, Rick, go on Google or just go to my site and search for a camera called the Fujica STF.
It's the same camera.
Yeah, it's the same camera. So I assume Fuji originally made it. I know it was exported to Australia, so maybe some of Theo's friends has one. In Australia, it was called the Hanamax 35 Reflex Flash. And then I think after that is when Continental is just a name. It's not a company. Yeah. Whatever company made it took the design and just kept reproducing them through like the 90s. I think you could still buy that camera new in like 1996.
Yeah, so somebody at Fujica actually did the design work on this, I guess. Or whoever Fujica stole it from. I remember when these things were new and, you know, with no shutter speed control, they gave the impression of just having one shutter speed and you'd only pick apertures. And they really were not cheap enough to justify that kind of specifications. Like I said, I got one just as kind of a joke to see what they were like inside. And then when I saw the inside of it, it took me a while to figure out exactly what they had done. And it really, it delivers a hell of a lot of performance for just a total absence of specifications. But again, they didn't sell it cheap enough to make that all work because you still have a fixed lens of f2.8. You still don't have control over your shutter speeds. They were asking too much money for what they were giving you. But the way the thing is built, you know, it's like one of those Time magazine giveaway cameras almost. And yet it delivers, it's a genuine SLR with a glass prism and a proper focusing screen, which I was really surprised at that. I was expecting chrome-plated plastic inside there.
Well, and it's got a in-body flash too. I mean, it's got a fairly typical point-and-shoot style flash built in.
Yeah, built-in flash, but the flash only works at one ISO setting because there's no way to adjust anything. So if you're going to use the flash, it's got an automatic coupling to the focusing ring, but that coupling is only correct for ISO 100.
Where were they sold, Paul? I never saw these cameras in the market.
I don't know who sold them. I mean, were they giveaways? I mean, were they like Bentleys or Windsors?
The only place I saw them, I remember seeing a write-up on them when they were new in Popular Photography towards the back of the magazine, which would have been, I want to say, around 1980. And I think there were a couple of listings of them in some of the fine print ads in the back of some of those magazines, but I never saw one in a store. I don't know where they sold them or how they tried to sell them.
I mean, I don't remember any distributor.
No.
You know, even some of the marginal ones.
Yeah.
Who would have had those?
At the time that Fujica was involved in this, they were making good cameras. You know, they were STF1s and whatnot, and they just had, this didn't fit with anything that they were doing.
No, at that time, Fuji would have been distributed by EPOI, I think, at that time.
That would have been 70s, though, Paul, late 70s.
I could never find a date for when the Fuji version came out, but I believe it to be late 1970s when the Fuji version and then the Hanamax versions were sold. That's actually one of the very few reviews. If you go through all the reviews I've done on my site, in the title of the review, I always put the name of the camera and then in parentheses the year I think it was made. And I don't have a date for that one because it could be anywhere from very early 80s to the late 90s. Nobody knows. The only thing that I was able to find, and now that I'm looking, the link is broken. Stupid me, I should have downloaded it. But there was a place in Chatsworth, California called Dot Line Corporation that at one point sold that camera.
Well, Dotline was one of the more marginal wholesalers.
Yeah.
So, and that doesn't mean that they made it, you know, it's just, they probably bought a truckload of them from China and they got them at, you know, $10 a pop. So they tried selling them mail order for 30 or something.
Now, Dotline was a distributor that they really never sold direct to consumer.
I don't know. I expect whoever wound up with it was a lot like buying a boatload of Pentagons in 1965.
Or Kievs in the late 80s as well, right?
Yeah.
All Kaminsky.
I used and wrote about the Hanamix one before. And from what I can vaguely remember, they talked about in some of the stuff I was reading that it was like updated a few times too. So like some of them had like different features from other ones.
There were some cosmetic variations that I've seen.
Yeah, there was like, I think some of them added like a self timer or something. I can't quite remember, but there was definitely like an early and like a later version.
Probably out of necessity is my guess.
No, these were fixed lenses, weren't they? There were no...
Yeah, yeah, right, fixed lens. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it could not... There's no way in the world you could make this work with an interchangeable lens. And there, I did find some reference to where they supposedly were about to introduce or had introduced an interchangeable lens version of this. But if you look at the way this is done, you really couldn't do that because your lens diaphragm is your shutter, kind of like the Pentax Auto 110 is.
Well, that was an unexpected promotion for a rare Hong Kong Chinese camera. But we are getting to that point where we want to start winding down. It is Monday the 18th as we're recording this, so we keep talking about the Cincinnati show. I cannot promise this episode will be done being edited by then. But in the event that it is, it would be cool to meet some people, come check out the show. We'll be there. I'm actually going to be in, Ray and I will both be getting there late Friday night. Paul won't show up into the morning because he's much closer and doesn't need to drive as far. But between Paul and I, we have four tables. I alone probably have enough to fill all four of those tables. So depending on what Paul and I have together, there's going to be probably boxes on the floor too. Of 1950s Japanese TLRs and Voigtlander Brilliance. I'm looking forward to it. I really hope we have a good turnout. The last show I went to in Chicago, I had a really great turnout. So sometimes these can be hit or miss, but I'm looking forward to seeing Ray again and maybe some of you guys. And while I won't promise we'll give everything away for free, I'm quite certain that Camerosity listeners, volume discounts apply. And although I only made one for myself, I'll have my Camerosity podcast t-shirt.
So I guess I won't be bringing the t-shirt cannon, huh?
We have a QR code on the back. So when people see Paul and I walking around, you could scan our backs and it takes you to our website.
But Mike, are you really giving away that Leica M6?
The Leica M6? Yeah, I'm going to give it away to the first person who wants it. yeah. No, I mean, in all seriousness, you know, I hoped to unload some stuff. Like I said, I like meeting people. To me, that's part of the fun of this too. So if you guys are anywhere near the area, Rick, if you could make it, if not, no big deal. Theo, you're welcome to come. Anthony had to drop. Tim, I don't think you're gonna be able to dig yourself
if you're
out.
Giving away an M6, I'll fly over.
Yeah, Mike, it's about, I'd say, a 20-hour drive for me.
20-hour drive. Well, then you got to dig yourself out too.
Oh yeah.
By the way, guys, if ever you guys make it up to Montreal, we have two installments of the Montreal Camera Show, which is basically exactly what you guys are talking about in Cincinnati. We have one here, comes in the fall and comes in the spring, and it's coming up on the 14th of April. So ever you guys are anywhere near Montreal,
yeah, there you go, promote it. And do you sell there?
I visited with my uncle and we purchased, but we're thinking about setting up a table maybe next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Since we're promoting a few camera markets, the Sydney camera market is on the 7th of April, Sunday the 7th of April.
Wow. Okay.
So
nice.
Anybody should turn up to that.
I want to give a quick shout out to CJ Dehug. Sorry, CJ, if you listen, I can't pronounce your name. CJ runs a website called CJ's Classic Cameras. He's based out of the UK. Another one of those kind of websites that's been around much longer than mine. And, you know, early on, like Rick's, was a good source of information for me. And he's a guy that I would reach out to every once in a while when I had a question. And he was always super helpful for me. But we've conversed back and forth a number of times in a lot of storage cameras. There were a couple Bolta Fotovits.
that I had. Nothing really too incredible, except there was this one that looked unlike any other Fotovit I'd ever seen before. Most Fotovits were used Bolta film, which was a Japanese style of, it was popularized in Japan, but it was really 35 millimeter film rolled on the special paperbacked reels. Well, they made a very small number of Fotovits to use Kodak's 828 film. But what's interesting is every version that you could find online in any book, any reference, the Fotovit 828s always say engraved 8/4/828 film on the base of the camera. All of them do. It's literally engraved in the metal, and they're all branded as a Fotovit camera. Well, I found one that did not say 4/8/28 film, even though it very clearly was, because the film compartment's completely different between 8/28 and Bolta film. But the branding of the camera was Bolta rather than Fotovit. Now, Bolta is the name of the company that made it, but they didn't sell them that way normally. So anyway, so I contacted CJ and said, had you ever seen a variant like this before? He's like, wow, I never knew about that. He wanted to know if it was for sale. I didn't have any real loyalty to it. So we agreed to a swap. I said, I don't want any money for it, but maybe give me something from your collection that might be kind of cool, something I've never seen before. And he ended up sending me three cameras, but my two favorites is a British camera called an Agilux Agimatic. It's a very tiny little camera. It reminds me of the Braun cameras, very compact. It's one of those where when you take the back off to load film in it, the sides come off too. It's an uncoupled rangefinder. I mean, compared to, you know, here is a Yashica SLR. I mean, you can see this thing is significantly smaller than a typical SLR would be, but it's a full frame 3500 camera. And then staying within the Fotovit realm, the company that made the Fotovits did make one regular 35 millimeter film version called the Fotovit 36. And once again, this kind of looks like a Braun too, but it's a unique body. It has a decal interchangeable lens mount. This one's got a coupled range finder and a selenium meter. Very German. You know, it's got the rounded edges. It's got an Enowerk Munchen 50 millimeter f/2.8 lens on it. So super cool cameras, neither of which I've ever even seen before. CJ's classic cameras, you guys, I would imagine, have at least stumbled upon his site before, because he's got a wealth of information too. And like Rick, he likes to tinker, not for other people, but just, you know, it improves his odds of having a working camera if he could fix it himself. So that was kind of a fun pickup. But before we go, though, does anybody else have any questions for Rick? Or any quick pickups that you wanted to share with us?
Question for Rick now. Very early TLRs, namely like the Rollei Flex K1, had a little spirit level attached to the ground glass. How feasible would that be to make in the modern day? Because I think that's a great, like I use it all the time on my Rollei Flex K1, and I just wish more TLRs had that. How hard would that be to make now?
Well, it wouldn't be hard to do. It might be hard to do a nice, clean job of it. What the Rolleiflex had, I think the standards may have been different, but I know some of the ones that I've seen had a little, the spirit level is a separate piece held in by a little piece of spring wire below the ground glass that just sort of held it up against the bottom of the glass.
Mine seems to be, it's a piece of just the standard ground glass, just run-of-the-mill ground glass, and there is a, like a cup shape of glass, and it's actually cemented to the bottom end.
Yeah.
So that seems it would be a little bit easier to make, I would assume.
Is yours a original Rolleiflex?
Yes, the K1, the very first model.
Yeah, I that's the way I recall it. I think it was the old standard that had it as a separate piece. If you found a suitable small bubble level like that, it would be possible to cement it to the bottom of a ground glass with Canada balsam type cement, something like that. You have to be very careful about how you're handling things. If you're working with glass, if you get cement on it, you can take solvent and clean it off. If you're working with a plastic molded bright screen type screen, you really can't do that. So you have to keep everything very clean and get it right the first time. There's no cleaning up after or any do-overs.
All right, thank you.
I have a quick question for Rick. What's one of the hardest things you've worked on before?
Probably the worst I can think of was Hasselblad 1000F. and I never succeeded in getting that thing back together. I could make the shutter run while the shutter crate was out of the body, but you have to take the winding knob and some of that stuff off it to get it back into the body and then put it back on. And there must have been some special tool or something at Hasselblad that I just could not make it run. When I got it back together, it ran as well as it had run when I received it. When I had the shutter out of the body, everything ran fine. When I put it back in, I don't remember if it ran like from a 25th up or something like that. But electricity and I do not get along well. So I try to confine myself to as little involvement with electricity as I possibly can. And I'm proving that with the electronic injection in my Mercedes.
Great. Well, good questions. You know, Rick, as always, it's great to hear from you. You know, we exchange emails now and then. Like I said at the beginning of the show, we haven't talked to you since episode 2. Please don't be a stranger. You are welcome back anytime. We do these shows usually every other week. Sometimes we'll go every 3 weeks or whatnot, but I always post the join link on my website. We do it on our Facebook page. We've been doing it on the Discord server recently, Instagram. We try to hit as many of the major, you know, social media networks to diversify our following. And, you know, we also like to help out other, you know, fledgling podcasts too. So if you're interested in some other great, you know, lens talk, I highly recommend the I Dream of Lenses podcast with Rick and Morty. That's a pretty good one to check out as well. Our next show is going to be recorded 2 weeks from today, which is April 1st, April Fool's Day. So maybe we'll have some fun with that one, but we don't have any specific topics lined up or any special guests. I'm sure we'll have something fun to talk about. But as always, the topics and discussions on the Camerosity podcast are determined and influenced by you guys. We want as many people as possible to come with us. Don't feel like you have to have the level of knowledge or collecting for as long as we have. We welcome users, collectors, just enthusiasts of all ages, shapes, sizes, ethnicities, podcast experience, you name it. But thanks guys for coming on the show, and we'll see you next time.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Bye-bye. Have a good
night. Thank you.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Another smash hit episode in the bag.